Love Sport Radio. On digital radio, online, mobile, and smart speaker. This is Upfront on Love Sport.
You're listening to Upfront with James Gray, the podcast edition. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1 till 3 p.m. on Love Sport Radio.
This is Love Sport.
Quite obviously, the biggest one from yesterday was, of course, Arsenal. Just rolling over and having their bellies tickled at Goodison Park. Frankly, they were feeble. A Premier League season, you know, and this is appropriate because obviously it was the Grand National on Saturday. Gives this year if you had a win on Tiger Roll? No. Oh, right, okay. I've actually got a very big celebration from the control room, so that's annoying. I did not, obviously. I had almost every other horse in the race. Well, I had Rathvinden, so that sort of slightly made me feel better. But the Premier League season is a bit like the Grand National, actually, because there are no easy fences. Some teams will fall by the wayside early on, and by the end, only the best trained will stay on to finish in the top four and reward the punters who have taken on an each-way bet. This year, Liverpool and Man City are neck and neck, but lengths clear of the rest of the pack. Tottenham had been running in the front two, but tripped over their own hooves. Chelsea are doing their best to unseat their rider. Manchester United have swapped the whip for a carrot halfway round and surged back towards the leaders. And Arsenal, facing a series of hurdles that the other top horses have long since learned how to clear, seem unable to jump them without first being shown the way by another horse. Every time a gap appears, they choose first refusal. All right, okay, this metaphor is starting to break down a little bit, but you get the general point. It was all in front of Arsenal, a tricky but not insurmountable run of away games against, you know, the likes of Everton, upper mid-table sides who are good and challenging, but they should win. If Arsenal want to finish in the top four, if a horse has genuine chances of bringing home an each-way bet in the Grand National, it has to get over the fences that the other good horses are getting over. It has no choice in that matter. So Arsenal need to learn to win these games. Because they've got a lot of them, by the way. And I actually said, a couple of weeks ago, I looked at the fixture list and said, Arsenal won't make top four. And the reason being, their last four away games of the season, or last five, I should say, Everton, Watford, Wolves, Leicester, Burnley. All quite similar types of team in terms of stature, in terms of style of play to a certain extent, and all perfect for Arsenal to turn up and not get a single win out of any of them. Sixth place has got the Gunners written all over it. I mean, yesterday there was so much flat-footedness in defence. If you look at the first goal, Phil Jagielka's scrappy finish, the ball bounces around the six-yard box a couple of times, and Socrates, who Arsenal fans tell me has been the one reasonably reliable part of the Arsenal defence, just watched it. He just seemed to watch it. And I don't know whether... Maybe Arsenal lulled themselves into a false sense of security. Or maybe there was just a falseness of feeling all round because Unai Emery reckons that his team were in control of the first half. I mean, they definitely didn't control the second half. So maybe by comparison, they did control the first half. But in all parts of the pitch, they lacked that sort of vim. You know, Dominic Calvert-Lewin was on Match of the Day 2 afterwards. And he said the first time he ran in behind Arsenal, they were terrified to death. Now, really, an Arsenal defence being terrified to death by an England under-21 striker who really hasn't exactly set the world alight, that is a shocking turn of affairs when you consider what Arsenal is supposed to be, the great Arsenal. They are not that anymore. That seems very, very clear to us. So they just stood and watched the game drift away from them, as far as I can tell. Everton showed an intensity. And I know this all comes from someone like Idrissa Gueye, who is a machine in midfield who really does get the team going. But it was all over the pitch. And that word intensity gets thrown around a lot in football. What does it actually mean? I think it's the shade of your performance. It's not specific things, but it's the overall colour of the things that you do. It's about being ready for anything, springing onto, for example, a quick free kick, as Everton did in the first half, and nearly caught Arsenal napping. Frankly, catching Arsenal napping yesterday was not difficult, given that they were asleep for about 85 minutes. It's a bit like catching your grandmother asleep at Christmas. There's no point in taking photos anymore, because she's just going to be asleep from 2 o'clock onwards. Just get used to it. That's what turkey and sherry does to you. And Arsenal were like that. They were like turkey and sherry-filled grandmothers yesterday. They were absolutely horrific. And you know, you can start a game with some intensity, and it doesn't stay, necessarily. It can go away. And it starts usually with one player. You see someone failing to chase down a ball here or giving the ball away and not getting back into position. And that sort of disease of just laziness almost starts to seep into the whole team like an infection. And when you're away from home, that's when it really, really matters. And you have to keep that level higher for even longer. I think this is a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy, because as soon as teams realise that you're vulnerable to that kind of pressure, as soon as people started to see that they could get into Arsenal, and this happened 7 years ago, as soon as they realised they could really get into them, they all did it, and it always worked, and Arsenal knew it was coming, and they lacked, it seemed, the personality, the character in the team to come out and say, right, we know they're going to get after us, and we're going to enjoy it, we're going to relish it, because the good teams, the really good teams, utilise the aggression, like a great counter-punching boxer. They duck and they weave and they absorb the pressure, and then they capitalise on the overbalancing of a big swinging hook. And that's what Arsenal have failed to do, if you ask me. They look like a big hitter who's lost some of his muscle mass, lost some of his strength, and doesn't know how to become a different type of fighter. Like David Haye in the later days, he'd lost some of that ability that he had to duck and move, and he couldn't work out how to evolve as a boxer. Arsenal have not evolved as a football team, and they haven't done for a decade.
Love Sport.
Everton were good. Let's be honest, you know, they had 23 shots on goal with just 43% possession. That tells you that you're being efficient, you're being incisive, and you're being direct. And they were all of those things in spades. It was impressive. Arsenal, as I say, did not offer much in terms of competing at the level of intensity. I think they just found it too easy. Everton just found it too easy to break away, to nick the ball and know that Arsenal would not be breathing down their necks trying to get it back. You know, Unai Emery talked about trying to make a balance between attack and defence. It wasn't about balance. It was about knowing that when you lose the ball, you have to chase it down. You can't just watch the other team attack and hope your defence get you out of trouble. Especially when you're an Arsenal player, by the way, because their defence is awful anyway. They're never going to get you out of trouble. Let's speak to someone who knows more about Everton than almost anyone, maybe. George Telfer played more than 100 times for Everton in the 1970s and 80s, and he's on the line now. George, Everton really, really did make Arsenal look pretty poor yesterday, didn't they?
They certainly did. They played absolutely brilliant. I thought their determination, their drive, their enthusiasm, it was absolutely superb.
Has that been a little bit lacking at times with Everton this season? I remember seeing them try to do it against Manchester City. I mean, I know they're a different proposition, but you know, they tried to come out and play this high-intensity game against City and it didn't last very long. Do you think they've cracked it now?
I think so. I think he's got the right formation at the moment. I like the two players that are playing out wide, Bernard and Richardson, you know, and we seem to be getting behind the back of teams and getting some decent balls in. You know, yesterday we could have had three or four quite easily, but it was just unfortunate. But, you know, I think he has got the right system at the moment.
Dominic Calvert-Lewin obviously didn't get a goal yesterday, but I saw him on Match of the Day talking to Ian Wright, amongst others, and he's a well-spoken lad, and he sort of talks a good game. How impressed have you been with his desire and his sort of willingness to do the hard yards up front?
I thought he was absolutely brilliant yesterday. It's a very, very lonely place when you're up front and you're on your own, you know, and he was battling for everything yesterday. You know, and his determination, his drive, it was superb.
What's the... I was going to say, when it comes to players like him, what is the overall goal? Do you think he's the kind of guy who will see Everton as a bit of a stepping stone? Or actually, does he want to be the one who takes them into that next level, back into that top six?
I think he wants to take it to the next level. You know, he's only a young lad. I think he's yet to make his mark, you know, in the Premier League, you know, and, you know, a few more goals behind him, and you never know what he'll achieve, to be perfectly honest. But yesterday, you know, he challenged for every high ball, you know, and his determination was brilliant.
What's the end game for Everton now? They're ninth after that win yesterday. I know they've played one more game than most of the teams around them, but You know, we talk a lot about the top six in the Premier League and the bottom 14. Do you think that they are good enough, you know, if they get a little bit of that consistency, to actually challenge the likes of Man United, Arsenal, Chelsea on a regular basis?
That's a difficult one. I'd like to say yes, and I know a lot of Evertonians are hoping that, you know, we can start challenging, you know, to get in the top six or in the top four. You know, the top four at the moment, they are a cut above everybody else. You know, and we're just a little bit of a step behind them at the moment. You know, we haven't had the most brilliant season. You know, but we've got a little run together now. We were conceding a lot of goals early on, but you never know. You know, I hope and pray like a lot of other Evertonians.
George Telfer there, former forward for Everton back in the 70s and 80s.
Love Sport.
It's Guy Watts, posh sports reporter, freshly hung over from the boat race, no doubt. Oh, no, sorry, I've forgotten you didn't get in, so it doesn't really count.
How dare you?
I'm sorry. The boat race, we'll pretend it didn't happen. Although, apparently, there's only one bloke in the Cambridge boat.
Yeah, he did it all on
just
his own.
Just that crack.
The old fella.
Yeah, the old guy, 46.
Great story.
Honestly, what's he ever won before? This is the pinnacle of his rowing career, I'm sure. But we're not here to talk rowing between two posh universities that Guy didn't get into. We're here to talk golf, of course, because it's the Masters on Thursday. Probably my favourite major. I think a lot of people.
I think everyone's. And I know being British, you sort of are
supposed to
like
to
the Open.
Yeah.
And I do like the Open. It's a clear second. You know, the other two American ones can I can sort of take or leave a little bit. But the Masters is hard to beat. It's always the first one of the year, of course. So it gets those juices flowing for golf again if they've sort of subsided a little bit over the winter. And it is a course that just doesn't really compare. No, nowhere else compares with it, let's be quite honest.
No, and of course, we're always desperate to have an English winner. You know, we had Danny Willett.
Three years ago now.
I mean, it's been a long 3 years as well, and we'll come on to that,
I'm sure. A long 3 years for Danny in particular.
Yes, specifically. But I think you want to talk a little bit about Tommy Fleetwood.
I do. There's an interview in today's Daily Mail with him, an exclusive interview. And he's a guy that we'll all be keeping an eye on anyway, because he's become one of the most high-profile, most prominent European and British players over the last couple of years. But I think he's maybe more worth keeping an eye on this week than he ever has been before at Augusta, because he's someone that, you know, a regular contributor to Love Sport, one of our golf experts, Tom Reed, who's the senior teaching pro at Stoke Park. He's been tipping him for a little while, saying that he's going to be a player to really watch. But he's got real pedigree in majors, Tommy Fleetwood, remember. He's still only 28, and at the last two US Opens, he's come fourth and second. And remember, the US Open, for some of its other flaws, if you like, it is the hardest one.
It's difficult.
It prides itself on being the most difficult tournament anywhere, really. And Tommy Fleetwood, in the most difficult tournament anywhere, has come fourth and second in the last 2 years. He's also had a good Masters last year. He shot a 66, five birdies in a row on day three, which put him in contention. I think he was out in the third to last group. Faded a little bit to come 17th, but he's a guy that knows the course well, and it is talking like a man who's really, really happy with where his game is, and so it should be. Of course, not just in stroke play, in match play, he and Molinari formed that incredible partnership, the first ever pairing to win all 4 points out of a possible four over the first 2 days of the Ryder Cup. He's a guy in extremely good form. He won in Abu Dhabi at the start of the season. He hasn't been playing brilliantly actually since then, but he says that he's actually happy that he feels like he's coming into this stage of the season, where of course the majors all come quite quickly now, all in the space of 3 or 4 months.
It's one a month, pretty much.
It is. He says this is the time to be hitting your stride, and I feel like I'm close to hitting my stride. It's a really exciting prospect, because of course you've got other well-known European and British players right in the mix as well. Justin Rose, world number two. But we are in this incredible situation where none of the world's top 10 have won a green jacket. I don't know when the last time a Masters would have been played where before the tournament none of the world's top 10 had a green jacket, but it can't have happened that often.
Well, you could, yeah. I mean, I can only think, yeah, because of Tiger, and it's very, very difficult to think of that ever happening. So it is sort of a wide open course. But you were saying, you know, Fleetwood knows the course. That is perhaps at Augusta more relevant, because of course the other three move around different golf courses. Augusta, you do play it every year, and you do tend to see the same sort of names.
Jordan Spieth in particular, and that'll be a really interesting one to keep an eye out for, because he has had a terrible year, really. Mm. He's been a bit all over the place, but there have been a few signs in the last couple of weeks that he's maybe coming back to some sort of form, but He's a guy that's obviously won several majors already. He's still only sort of mid-20s, 25 years old. Mm. He has an incredible, a phenomenal record at the Masters. He, of course, has reached a lower score, around Augusta, over four rounds at the Masters than any other player has when he reached 19 under in winning it a few years ago. And he's almost won it on a couple of other occasions since. So it'll be fascinating to see whether or not he can sort of reproduce a bit of the old magic this week. But he's not one of those players in the top 10. Of course, the stat wouldn't be valid because he has won at Augusta before. Rory McIlroy, though, quite ominously placed as world number three, he'll be favourite with the bookies because, of course, after ending that year-long drought for winning a tournament a couple of weeks ago at the Players, he has sort of put the early season form that saw him placing at everything into turned it into actual winning tournaments now. So that's an exciting prospect too.
It's also interesting to see Danny Willett back at the Masters. He, of course, won it, as you say, 3 years ago and must surely be the only Masters winner to miss his next two cuts at the Masters. I'd be surprised there's many others who've done that. He has had a tumultuous couple of years, am I right?
Yeah, he's had a very up and down couple of years on and off the golf course. It is interesting you say that. I don't know the stats on players to miss the next two, but I know, for example, Sergio Garcia missed the next cut after winning it 2 years ago. This does happen where, I guess, especially maybe with someone like Garcia, but for anyone, it's a crowning achievement in their career. You go about the next year, you've got everything. You've got the Champions Dinner on the eve of it. You've got so much going on, and you've also already in your head, maybe a little bit mentally sort of said, I've achieved it now, I've won it, and I don't have anything left to prove here.
Sort of lose the hunger for it.
Yeah, maybe you do a little bit. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see how Sergio fares this time around. But yeah, Danny Willett, he'll be hoping to sort of right his record that's gone so awry there the last couple of years. He's had problems, I think, with his mental health. He, of course, even by the end of 2016, was in the headlines for the wrong reasons in golfing terms due to a lot of stuff that wasn't all in his control at the Ryder Cup in America, where his brother said some very unfortunate things. So, unfortunately, yeah, we've heard a lot more about Danny Willett.
I remember when you say unfortunate things. He was just being a bit of a mouthy so-and-so on Twitter, basically, wasn't he?
And he even wrote an article for one of the big golf magazines where he said all those things he'd been saying on Twitter, but put it in writing, and a publication paid him to do so. And it really...
Clever.
Yeah, exactly. It soured things. It soured the experience for Danny. He talked about it as much. But what I did love was basically the article was criticising American fans, which we're going to hear a lot of course, at Augusta over the next few days. Criticising American fans. Danny Willett came out and said, look, I don't support those views at all. Love playing golf in America. He had a torrid time at the Ryder Cup. 3 days later, came out and said, yeah, he was completely right, actually. They're awful. I hate them.
I don't blame him. But he's, of course, been through a lot of injury problems as well.
Yes.
Chronic back problem, I think. Shoulder. And I was interested to read his interview today, sort of harking back to that 2016 victory. And he said, no one sits you down and says, when you win, this is going to happen. So one, now that he's been through a full cycle of being winner and missing the cut, then back in the field and missing the cut again, this is almost that he's been to rock bottom now. And it feels like, I mean, he's obviously not going to be the best English contender necessarily. I'm interested by the chances of Paul Casey, though, because obviously he won again. You know, we had that run of three Europeans, Francesco Molinari as well. I've always looked at Paul Casey and thought, he should be able to win the Masters.
He's got good finishes at the Masters. He's had a top five, I think I'm right in saying. I think it was back in about 2008. It was a long time ago. He's a much younger player, a different player to the one he is now. But he's another one who's talking about his game being in possibly better shape than it's ever been. He's 40 years old, remember now. So he's a later bloomer, if you like. But yeah, he retained the Valspar Championship just a couple of weeks ago.
Look, you've got five top tens at the Masters, by the way.
There you go, five top tens. You don't get five top tens at the Masters by accident. As you say, it's a course that, you know, you find out pretty quickly whether it suits you or not. It does suit Paul Casey. I wouldn't be that surprised to see him in the mix come Sunday afternoon. And on a European perspective, of course, you can't talk about Tommy Fleetwood anymore without talking a little bit about Francesco Molinari, who won his first major at the Open last summer, quite memorably holding off Tiger Woods and a host of others with a very, very steady and impressive round. And Tommy Fleetwood, sort of, they're great mates. They were great partners in crime at the Ryder Cup, but they're competitors as well. And he wants to make sure that he's not on zero majors for much longer, because the reality is with Fleetwood, he's put himself in contention enough times now that if he doesn't actually turn one of these contendings into a win, then there are going to be people saying, well, does he have the mentality to win a major or not? Which is probably unfair and it's premature at the moment, but a good performance this week would go a long way to answering
that. Yes, you don't want to turn into the next Colin Montgomery in any shape or form. Although he's a very rich man, so mate, I wouldn't mind being the next Colin Montgomery. I'd happily be the next Colin Montgomery.
But James, you wouldn't be happy.
Monty's never happy, so exactly. I assume not.
He could be as rich as anyone in the world and he still wouldn't be any fun.
Love Sport.
Chelsea, of course, are in action tonight. They're taking on West Ham at Stamford Bridge. It's an 8 o'clock kickoff if you are going. If you are going, you're one of the few, as far as I can tell, because Chelsea didn't sell out initially for this game. It went on general sale. I'm just trying to buy some tickets at the moment. I don't think it's sold out yet, which is, let's face it, for a Premier League game and for a top six Premier League team, that is quite rare. So, look, there were some suggestions that this is part of a fan boycott. I don't think that's the case. I think it's more really that it's a Monday night game. But it doesn't mean that Chelsea fans aren't unhappy with the way the team are playing at the moment. Let's ask former Chelsea player David Lee, who's on the line now. David, do you think fans are right to be a little bit discontented with the way Chelsea are playing at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, obviously fans have always got their own opinion. You know, if you're not winning leagues because they've been used to winning things in the last few years, they're always going to be up in arms if we're not challenging for the title. So, yeah, from that point of view, yeah, I think fans are always going to be fickle like that.
I suspect from what you're saying there that you think they should maybe just get on with it. They're not doing that badly.
Yeah, but you tried telling that, you know, a fan that, you know, he's used to success in the last sort of 10, 15 years. But no, I mean, sometimes it's a change. I go through it where, you know, I go with, you know, a lot of the older players have left and they're, you know, blooding new players, or as in this case, a new manager's come in, he's trying to implement his style. People sort of say, oh, yeah, you know, give him time and all that. But sometimes, you know, you don't get given the time. And I think a lot of fans aren't going to probably give Sarri the time that he may require.
Would you sort of sympathise with fans who say, we want, it's not necessarily success, we just want to see decent football? At the moment, they're playing quite tedious football and not playing that well either.
Yeah, of course you can sympathise. I mean, I don't watch him every week, unfortunately, but some of the games I've seen, you know, haven't been great, the way they've been playing, because they have got some good players and, you know, he plays the way he wants to play. At the end of the day, you know, if he doesn't come up with the goods, he's just going to be down the road very soon. But, yeah, you can sympathise with the fans when you know, if they're not playing well and winning, different. If you're not playing well and not winning, it's even worse.
What do you make of Maurizio Sarri as a manager? We've nearly had a year of him now. We know what type of football he plays. He's quite a sort of unusual character on the touchline. Would you be happy to see him do another year at Chelsea?
It depends, I think. I think if this transfer ban goes ahead and they're not going to have any money to spend, it's going to be difficult to get a big name in, I think, if you want a big name on to replace him. If they don't get the ban, then I probably would like to see a change, personally.
What sort of manager would you be looking at? There's a lot of talk about Frank Lampard coming in. I have my own views on that. Do you think it would be the right time for Frank?
I think for Frank, it's always going to be the right time because obviously Chelsea legend. But would he want it so early in his tenure? That's a question that obviously Frank would have to answer. But I don't know. I would have liked Zidane personally. Obviously he's not going to be there now because he's gone to Real Madrid. I'd quite like someone like that. Or do you go down the route of Frank Lampard or John Terry?
I mean, the John Terry is also the one that fans have been looking forward to. Sarri's had to deal with English football and the difficulties that English football brings, and one of those things is playing a lot of games. I think Chelsea got 3 games in a week, and he was saying that he would take a pay cut in order to reduce fixture congestion. I think the reality of that might be rather different. But do you think it's...
You know, the way I look at it is, has he not watched English football then over the last 100 years? Because he knows that there's always lots of games, and if you're successful, you're going to play more games. So I don't think he can come out with that now saying, oh, you know, the fixture list is ridiculous. If you're successful, of course the fixture list is going to be, you know, more complicated, because that means you're winning games and you're longer in the competitions.
Yeah, it makes sense, doesn't it? But as a player, does that fixture congestion really get on top of you? You know, if you are playing 2 or 3 games a week, because usually when I speak to players, they say, now we'd rather be playing. But have you ever got to a point where you've thought, oh, I'm just really tired, I could do the week off?
No, 100% what a player would say, ask, and 99 out of 100 players would say, rather play than train, and play like every day, you know? They wouldn't be happy. They would be happy playing 3 days a week, no problem. They would rather that than training. You ask the Man City boys, you know, they're going for this quadruple. They'd be delighted playing every couple of days if it means they're going to win all the trophies.
Mm. Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, when you're winning, I suppose, that momentum. But when you're losing, does it get on top of you?
It can do, yeah. I mean, individually, everyone's different. But yeah, of course it can. If you got beat twice and you got another game, it's like, oh, here we go again, you know, if you're in that rut. But, you know, I think if you're down the bottom, it's a little bit, I mean, with all due respect, like Huddersfield and Fulham now, the last few games of the season, they know that there's no outcome. It's going to be difficult for them. But, you know, then they're professional. They have to play, you know, play with a bit of pride in that. But it is difficult.
David, thank you so much for joining us. That's former Chelsea defender David Lee.
Love Sport.
You all know if you're a regular listener, I'm a big boxing fan. And I'm always interested in new people and new formats in boxing especially. Now, one of those is Ultimate Boxer. That's Ultimate Boxer with two X's. You may not have heard of it before, but we are moving into the third edition of this innovative event. They'll be at Indigo at the O2 in London on Friday, May the 10th. It'll be live on BT Sport as well. 8 pro boxers, one night, 50 grand on the line, and they fight all the way down until they have one winner. It's a cool format, a little bit like Prize Fighter, if you remember any of that. And essentially, it's a chance for a lot of young, or actually not even necessarily young, but certainly previously unrecognised boxers to get the chance to fight on national TV, to bring their name to the nation and to make a name for themselves. It's not just about the prize money, really. Sure, 50 grand up top is ideal, and that's great. But it's not necessarily just about that. Now, to tell us a little bit more about this is the founder of Ultimate Boxer, Ben Shalom. Ben, tell us a little bit about where this idea first came from.
Hi, guys. Ultimate Boxer started at the start of last year, really. And we were from a big music and promotions background and just wanted to give something more to the sport. It's an amazing sport, but there's a lot of boxers that just struggle for chances, struggle for opportunities, and so we want to create something that would be really entertaining as a TV show, but also give amazing opportunities to the fighters too.
Did you have much of a boxing background? Did you box yourself, or were you a boxing fan beforehand?
Yeah, well, I know I worked in boxing for quite a while before I started Ultimate Boxer. Helped out with different promoter shows in terms of bringing new broadcasters to the table and sponsors and the general events, and so it came from having a lot of friends in the sport and a lot of friends that were fighters as well and unbeaten fighters and just that were just struggling for that TV deals and proper opportunity.
What would you say to someone who's not been to an Ultimate Boxer event before? What makes it different from maybe other boxing nights that you might go to?
Oh, it's completely different. It's almost like it's an event for everyone. It's almost as though you would go to any other kind of entertainment event. There's big music performers, there's amazing presenters, the fights. It's an 8-fighter tournament, so there's quarterfinal, semi-final, final all on one night. It's an X factor essentially for boxing, and our crowds are kind of from all different types of backgrounds, whether it's big celebrity audiences or girls, boys, everything, and that's kind of the difference. It's a major kind of experience and something that's not really comparable in anything else like boxing.
Now, of course, we've got this event coming up at Indigo at the O2 on Friday, May the 10th. It's middleweight, which is always one of my favourite weight divisions as well. Who are you particularly excited to watch? Have you got your eye on anyone in particular?
Yeah, the middleweight division is absolutely crazy in Britain right now. There's just so many. I think we were saying before we could have filled this 4 times over, and so it just kind of proved to us like how competitive it was, and so managed to kind of decide on an 8 for the London show, and there's some really good fighters in there. There's obviously the favourites with Kieran Conway, unbeaten 10-0. Fighter, only 22 years old as well, so be interesting to see how he does. But then you've got other favourites, Taylin Jones, Grant Dennis, title holders, previous title holders, and so it's very, very competitive now, British title level really all around, so yeah, it'll be exciting to see what happens.
In terms of boxing as a whole, because obviously you're a new force in there. You're not necessarily the established. We've got Eddie Hearn, we've got Frank Warren, and I think then people feel it's a bit of a hegemony. Did you come in and want to really disrupt that in some ways and provide something different?
I think what it is they've been, those guys, well, it's particularly the Barry Hearn, but Frank as well, has been around for so long that for us it was not, we didn't want to compete with what they do, what they do very well, and it was just about, we're from a kind of younger background, we consume content in different ways, and it was trying to create some of the 21st century fans as well. So yes, the traditional guys are still the big boys, and that'll remain the way for a long time. We just think we're doing something different, and we saw it. It's essentially those two that run boxing, so to speak. And so we worked hard to get our TV deals over the line. We now sit on BT and show on Box Nation as well. So we Frank's been kind to us with that as well. So no, they do what they do and very well. And we just saw there was a big gap for what we could bring to the sport.
Ben, thanks so much for coming on and telling us a bit more about Ultimate Boxer.
No problem.
It's been an absolute pleasure. That show is on Friday, May the 10th, Indigo at O2 London. Tickets still available as well. BT Sport will broadcast the Ultimate Boxer series live on TV and YouTube starting on Friday, May the 10th from the Indigo O2. I tell you, boxing in Britain is at a real high point. It really is at a point at which I think you can go to a decent show almost any weekend. And tournaments like this are special because sometimes you'll see someone who maybe you haven't heard of before, or you almost certainly haven't heard of before, but in a year's time or 2 years' time or 3 years' time, they might be fighting for a world title. And you can sort of go, well, actually, I saw them win Ultimate Boxer back in 2019. And I thought they were really good at that point. And to get the chance to see some of these guys as they move their way up, I think that's really important. And it's something that's a real great opportunity to do if it lands on your doorstep.
Love Sport.
I want to talk a little bit about, well, the FA Cup from the weekend was obviously massively dramatic. Well, it was at least on Sunday, Watford beating Wolves in that miraculous 3-2 comeback. But there was another game on Saturday, Man City beating Brighton, as we know. And there was a controversial moment when Kyle Walker, well, I don't know, appeared to throw a headbutt. No, I don't think that's fair at all. He came head-to-head with Brighton's Alireza Jahanbash, which was a moment that went to VAR and he was shown a yellow card. Now, a lot of people thought he should have been sent off. Fine, you can have that opinion. The VAR official clearly didn't agree. He thought it was a yellow card offence, no red card. Now, a lot of those people who thought Walker should have been sent off felt that he was given preferential treatment because he was playing for a top six club. Now, no matter what fans say, it's very hard to actually influence a game, in England especially, on the pitch. The FA Cup's not rigged. It's not driven towards the top six clubs so they get better viewing figures for the final. More to the point, it's much easier to create an advantage elsewhere. On the balance sheet, for example. And that is exactly what's happening. The bottom 14 clubs might as well start calling it an imbalance sheet. Because, frankly, that's what's happening. The money is being diverted away from them, one way or another. The Premier League sort of prides itself on the equality of it all. Of the financial model in particular. But it's quickly disappearing. Last summer, the Big Six, as they're quickly becoming, frankly, and much further away from the bottom 14, they pushed through a deal that changes the equality of the league. As of next season, around £1 billion of TV revenue that was previously shared equally will start being divided out based on league position. Remember that there's already an inequality on TV money because of the £5.1 billion of TV rights money, part of it is shared evenly and part of it is based on how many times a team is on TV. That massively favours the top six, because broadcasters will always choose those top six clubs to show on TV. And there is a conception that teams are supposed to be on at least 10 times a season. Actually, that's not the case. This season, three of them, Bournemouth, Huddersfield and Southampton, will only have been on 8 times. Now, I spoke to the Premier League this morning to try and clarify the regulations on this. They told me they pay clubs on a minimum of 10 games no matter what. So even if you're on only 8 times, you get paid as though you're on 10 times. There are quotas. Those quotas exist, but they are confidential. They're part of a contract between the broadcasters and the league. So, yes, sure, perhaps you have to have 8 games on TV, but you get paid as though there are 10. So that creates a little bit of a safety net. But you can't get away from the fact that the teams outside of the top six are still disadvantaged by the way the TV games are structured and by the money that's given out. Now, if you speculate the number is lower than 10, it's probably more like 8, you'd say they're missing out on all sorts of things that the Premier League brings for you, quite apart from the cash. You're saying they're not on TV as much, they can't build such a big fan base, they can't capitalise on commercial revenues as much. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. The more times you put a team on TV, the more popular they're going to become, the more revenue they're able to generate, both through the fact that you've put them on TV and from their international acclaim, and therefore the bigger they're going to become. It's going to go on and on and on until the bottom 14 are completely, completely detached from the top six in the Premier League. Last season, for example, and shout out to Nick Harris, Sporting Intel on Twitter, for the figures on this. Last season, the Big Six earned combined Premier League cash of £202 billion based on merit versus 40 for the bottom six. Fine. It's based on merit. You sort of think that's fair. All right. But in TV fees, they pocketed £190 billion compared to 75 for the six clubs showed the least. So that gives you an idea of the scale of money that's being filtered upwards. And what's great about the Premier League previously is you really, the difference between last and first was maybe, you know, 30% in terms of prize money. It's not that anymore. And it's going to get worse. And it stops the trickle down. It stops clubs being able. Because as soon as you realise, as an owner, that the top six is impenetrable, that it's impossible to catch up with those clubs, why would you even bother spending? Look at Mike Ashley. Why would he bother spending money on Newcastle when he knows the best he can do is seventh? He knows they're not going to make that much more money just because he's spent. And when the international TV deal changes next season and more of that money starts getting allocated based on places and not membership of the Premier League, that imbalance is only going to get worse. The natural progression of this is that the Premier League turns into La Liga, where there are two leagues within the league and no one wants that. It's not interesting. The majority of games in La Liga are barely worth watching. And that's because they already have one of the most unbalanced TV deals in Europe. Real Madrid and Barcelona get huge amounts more money than anyone else. It ensures their place at the top of Spanish football. No one's ever going to threaten them. No one wants the Premier League to turn to La Liga. Not least, by the way, the very TV broadcasters who are paying for the rights. And most importantly, the fans really don't. Because if you're a Newcastle fan or, you know, a Wolves fan, Leicester, Watford, what are you going to dream of? Other than the FA Cup, which is great, but you can't all get there all the time. Other than that, what are you going to achieve with your season? The whole point of the Premier League is it's the most competitive in the world. So if you want to complain about anything as fans, don't muddy the water with crackpot conspiracy theories about why Kyle Walker was given a yellow and not a red. It's not worth it. It makes it easy for the powers that be to dismiss you as tinfoil hat lunatics. Which, frankly, anyone who thinks Kyle Walker wasn't sent off because he's a City player is, in my opinion. They don't get preferential treatment from the referees. They do get preferential treatment from the money makers, from the people who sign the checks. So don't let them dismiss you as a crackpot loon. Point out that the Premier League is in a very real danger of becoming so hungry that it eats itself, and then we'll have nothing left at all.
Love Sport.
Of course, looking back at a massive weekend of Premier League action. Now, on Fridays, I get forced, and I say forced because it really is, I get backed into a corner, basically, to predict Premier League and FA Cup fixtures, just basically so that on a Monday, we can all sit around and have a good laugh about how poorly I've done. Now, the thing is that, fortunately, I didn't put any money on these predictions, because otherwise, I don't know how well I'd have done. Let's find out. The first one, let's have a listen to what I thought about Watford versus Wolves. I mean, this is as difficult as it gets. Let's face it, you've picked the hardest game for me to predict straight out of the blocks. And I don't like it because I would really like Watford for, you know, everything that they've got, the connections we have with the club here. But I just think that Wolves will be able to play on the counter-attack against them. The pace of it and everything that they've got will, I think, just be too much. So I think I have to go with Wolves. I think it's going to be a very edgy game. I'm going to go with Wolves to win 1-0. Thanks. Thanks for that sound effect. Very loud in my ears. Okay, I may have got that one wrong. But also, Wolves should have won it. They should have won it. You know, they did throw it away. Let's be honest. They were 2-0 up. They had outplayed Watford for the most part. And they threw it away. So I rather think that I got a little bit unlucky with that one. I might have to say that a few more times, I fear. Let's have a listen to Saints versus Liverpool, my prediction. I think Liverpool get it done. Southampton, oh great, they've won two on the bounce in the Premier League. Great. I mean, honestly, they're so in a different league from Liverpool. I think Liverpool will win 2-0. I think they'll just be too strong. What are Southampton going to offer in that game? Really, what are they going to offer? 2-0 Liverpool. There we go. I got the right result, if not the right scoreline. But I'll take a little bit of credit there because I think, you know, I worked out. I got the right margin of victory. So I get the tick, a generous tick. No round of applause. I think when I get it exactly right, then Ben will crack out the dusty round of applause button, which very, very rarely gets used on this particular one, particular show especially. Oh, Huddersfield versus Leicester. Here we go. Relegated Huddersfield host Brendan Rodgers Leicester. A thriller. A score draw. 3-3, I reckon. Yes, I did get that one wrong. I did think there would be goals in it, and there were goals in it. So that's my silver lining to that particular enormous rain cloud. I can't remember what I said for Everton versus Arsenal. It's the Kevin Campbell derby, isn't it? Because as it's obviously known, friend of Love Sport Kevin Campbell, big legend for both clubs. Everton are 10th, but they could go as high as 8th with a win. They've been playing all right, and last time came to London, beat West Ham, but West Ham were very, very poor defensively, which is, of course, what Arsenal are all the time. Tough to call. I think it'll be 2-1 Arsenal, away win for the Gunners. Yeah, but come on. I mean, come on. Arsenal let me down there. No one really saw it coming, did they? I don't think so. I think I deserve some leeway there. Did I get anywhere near on Newcastle versus Palace? Again, difficult. Palace fans really hate what's going on with Roy Hodgson at the moment. I think Newcastle at home might just have enough. They have impressed me in fits and starts at times, and I think Palace are going in the wrong direction. It's 13th versus 14th, and I think 1-0 Newcastle. It's not going to be pretty, but that's what I'm going with. Yeah, all right. It's not been a great weekend for James's predictions, but I looked at it. As soon as I looked at it, I thought that's a difficult group of fixtures. I could have predicted that Luka Milivojevic would have scored a penalty, though, because what is that, 11? 12? 12 now this season? The man's absolutely prolific. I saw a very good tweet, which was, name a more prolific duo than Luka Milivojevic and the penalty spot, I'll wait. Very funny. Give some credit to that. Ben's going to make me do one more prediction so that he gets a chance to embarrass me tomorrow. It's Chelsea versus West Ham. Very tough, because none of the Chelsea fans even want to turn up. That's how exciting this game is. West Ham are one of those teams who are extremely inconsistent, but they won't go, I think, with much ambition to Stamford Bridge. I'd be surprised if they went and tried to play too much free-flowing football anyway. I think it'll be a regulation 2-0 win for Chelsea.
Love Sport.
Former Watford midfielder Richard Johnson is on the line. Played for Watford for a long, long time, and I imagine has a little bit of a sore head today, Richard.
Yes, definitely. How are you?
Yeah, very well, mate. Tell me about the game itself. Obviously, going 2-0 down was far from ideal. Did you ever lose hope that Watford would come back?
Andre Gray had a couple of chances. He went with one with his foot in the first half, where I think he should have gone with his head. Mm. So although I think Wolves edged the first half, really, and obviously went the two goals up. We were always still in with a shout, and you had a sense that the way the season's gone, especially if we could have got a goal back, then we would have been in with a shout. So I don't think the sort of the negative feelings were there at all. Although it coming back from 2-0 was an extra special result, really.
It was funny listening to, I don't know if you heard Troy Deeney talking afterwards, but he was shown the replay of Raul Jimenez celebrating with a wrestling mask, and he basically said, yeah, better wear his mask now, he's a loser. How much of this Watford team is just raw passion?
Yeah, and I think that's been the difference for the last couple of seasons. You know, we've sort of got to that sort of safety mark, if you like, and performances have sort of dropped off, but this season, you go down the training ground and the atmosphere has just changed. There's, like you say, real passion, real drive, and the feeling around the, sort of the club is a little bit different this season. And that's been proven by the results on the pitch. And yesterday, to show that character, to come back from 2-0 down at Wembley was just incredible. And I know Troy talks about Cajonas, but he had a little bit of bottle to put that penalty away.
Well, yeah, I mean,
must have been.
He wasn't going to die wondering, was he? He was basically just going to smash it down the middle and see what happens. But sometimes that's the best way, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. Head down, hit it as hard as you can. All this sort of trying to place it or chip it. Yeah, we were, especially when Graham Taylor was here in the period that we had, if anybody missed the penalty by trying to be clever, it was not a good place to be, let me tell you. So, just run up and smash them.
Obviously, Watford have never won the FA Cup, and what people sometimes don't realise is that's pretty rare for top clubs. I know you were around the club anyway, perhaps when they got to the semi-final back in 2003. Does it have a particularly special feeling for Watford in particular? Is this more special because of they haven't got that monkey off the back a little bit?
Yeah, I think so. To be honest with you, there's been a couple of semis, but we've sort of never really done that well in the FA Cup, to be honest. But I think 84, obviously, against Everton. It'd be what a fantastic achievement it is. And I think on the pitch as well as off the pitch, the owners are investing. And the players that we've got are quite special. And you've got to give a shout out to the manager as well. He's offered that stability. He's done so well. You go down the training ground, everyone's happy. He's done well to manage the squad of players that he's had. And it's a good place to be at the moment.
I was going to ask you a bit about Javi Gracia, because he's not someone we necessarily know a lot about. How do you find him in whatever dealings with him? How do you find him? How do you think the players come across him as a manager?
Listen, he's always got a smile on his face. Everybody has fun at training, but obviously there's a serious side to him. You don't get to manage a Premier League side without having a bit of edge or a bit of sort of authority, really.
Yeah.
But it's just a good place to be at the moment. Training's always fun, upbeat, and the results on the pitch have sort of shown sort of his style, if you like. We've had a couple of blips this season, obviously Bournemouth at home, but overall we've been quite consistent, I think. I know people think we're sort of a little bit inconsistent, but if you look at the overall results, especially going into the game, Wolves had a little bit better press, really, than what we do. But you look at our sort of the way the games have gone, and we're sort of quite even with Wolves. So I think overall we've been fantastic this season, and get to a cup final for the fans, the club, everyone involved, it's just a massive achievement.
Watford haven't beaten Man City since 1989. I think there's about 16 games in that run. Any chance of reversing that cup final day?
Listen, you never say never, do you? It's a one-off game. They've got a lot of games on their plate coming up. They've probably got a Champions League to think about after that game. So you never know. It's always difficult on a big pitch like that. City can... They've got a squad of players that, if they turn up on the day, can beat any team in the world. So, but you never know. You've just got to go and give it a go. So, and I'm sure we will.
Just looking ahead, because obviously Watford, this success always puts a few players in the shop window. I know Abdoulaye Doucouré has talked a little bit about PSG and what that would mean to him if they come in for him. Are there a couple of players like him in this squad who you think, actually, if someone comes in and we lose them, there's not much we can do to keep them?
Yeah, you can say that. Obviously, Delapé comes with good pedigree, Barcelona, so there's always going to be interest in him because he can turn a game. He came on yesterday and turned the match for us. So there's always going to be interest in players like that. But for looking sort of even younger for us, Will Hughes, what fantastic seasons he had. He's a class player, Will, and I think he should be in and around that England squad, to be fair. I know Troy's come out and said it, but he's gone on. And look at Ben Foster, what he's done for us in goal this season. Has been fantastic. So there's players sort of in and around that squad. Mariappa's been solid again for us, Cathcart. But yeah, there's obviously players that are going to attract interest. But I think big shout out has to go to Andre Gray this season. Last season didn't have the best of times. Confidence was low. But this season he's looked a different player. A couple of goals, and he's looked sort of playing up sort of alongside Troy, if you like, having a bit of a partner to bounce off. And he's looked a different player for us this season. So, there's been performances all over the park, really.
Richard, thanks so much for joining us. I know you've had a difficult day recovering from yesterday, but a joyous occasion anyway. And thanks very much for your time. That's Richard Johnson, former Watford midfielder, who I think may have had a shandy or two after the 3-2 win over Wolves at Wembley after extra time.
This is Love Sport.
You've been listening to Upfront with James Gray, the podcast edition. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1 till 3 p.m. on Love Sport Radio. And don't forget to leave us a rating and a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.